my man. How you doing over there?
Doing all right. How about yourself, man?
Yeah, doing good. One of my dogs is a little sick, so we had a little rough night in the ER for a bit. He's probably okay. He's going through it a little bit. So it's just been sad. They can't communicate. It's just rough. You know how it is.
Yep. Oh, I know.
Yep. What are you up to?
Middle of book. Any free time? You know how these projects go too. When you're trying to put something together that's like everything you know, you're constantly thinking, oh, I gotta add that. And then you sit down and start adding it, you realize you're adding too much. And so it's kind of constant revision and making sure that I'm just talking about the things I want to talk about and making sure it's clear. That's consuming most of my life right now.
Yeah, I've never had a piece of content that the revising process wasn't primarily focused on making it shorter and more concise.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yep.
Let's talk about the book a little bit, because you authored The Hybrid Athlete, right?
Yeah.
What it's called. Yeah. Great book. But you are working on version 2.0. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So when I first wrote The Hybrid Athlete, it was actually kind of an interesting history behind it. Back in like 2011, 2012, I was writing a lot of articles on the training style that I was doing. This is kind of back in the day of like, you know, big message boards and training journals and all that. And I had a lot of interest in what I was doing there. So I started formally writing articles for a couple sites. And I started talking to the guys over at JTS, and they were like, hey, this is really great stuff. There's a lot of interest in this. Why don't you put it together? We'll put it into an ebook and we'll get it out to people. I said, okay, that's cool. Took a lot of articles and basically made them into a book. And that was the first Hybrid Athlete. It's only been like 9-10 years since the book came out, but it's probably been like 12 years since that content was written. And I was kind of like, you know what? I'm spending so much time on education now and, you know, really fine tuning. I feel like I'm at a point in my game here where, hey, there's a lot more to say and there's a lot more to add. So I started writing this book, and it's kind of like, it is now formally everything I know about hybrid training. It's everything I know about endurance training, strength training, everything else put together, summarized, made clear, and here's how you apply it to hybrid training. So that's what it is. And it sounds like a lot, and it is, which is why I'm spending so much time making it short.
If somebody read the first book or not, what were maybe some buckets that you felt, yeah, I have more to say on this, or something different to say on this versus the first time around?
Well, I think the first one is a great conceptual overview of like, hey, here's hybrid training. You can do it. Here's some basic rules and all that. But I still feel like coming out of that, people are still like, all right, that's interesting. But all right, what exactly do I do? Like, how do I program endurance training? Not just like, all right, so do, you know, a lot of easy, a little bit hard and all that. There's a lot more detail to it. And I think what I'm trying to do with this book compared to the first one is, rather than just introducing ideas, it's kind of like saying, okay, and here's how you actually do it. Here's what you've got to know to do it for yourself. And I think this book is really trying to give people the tools they need to do this themselves. I think that's the biggest difference.
Yeah, chuckle, because probably 10 years ago, like, it was enough to just be doing. I know that it's not true, like, to say that like hybrid training is like this new thing, like people have been running and lifting forever sort of thing, but it's certainly like in more of the mainstream these days. And it's funny that like probably 9-10 years ago, just getting somebody to be like, ooh, that's interesting, I could do both, I guess, was enough, you know? And so like now you're like, okay, it's not enough anymore. I need to also maybe add to this thing to give people who are now maybe more excited about it, maybe a little bit more actionable steps. Yeah.
Yeah, man, there was so much resistance to it. And I think that's really been kind of the interesting thing. A lot of people now, you know, you'll even see on like TikTok and Instagram are like, oh, we've been doing this like the last 10 years. I'm like, no, you haven't. 10 years ago, there was still very much this vibe that if you were a lifter, you either did sprints or nothing. You did not do cardio, and vice versa. And so this is actually still, it may seem old to people who've been around for a while, I think even just with the pace of information now, but it's still pretty new.
Yeah, you are, if you Google the coining of the phrase hybrid training, yeah, you are attributed to having said that, let's say, or coining it. I don't know how much you care about whether or not you are that person, but I'm curious if just you, I'm sure you have an affinity or an attachment in some way to that terminology. But the reason I'm saying that is because, have you seen these like memes, and these memes have been out there that are like, thank God, like somebody created the term hybrid athlete, because otherwise it would just be like mediocre lifter, shit runner. And I'm like, it, like hybrid athlete sounds way cooler. And so I was just like, chuckle if you see those and you're like, yeah, that was me. Like, you're welcome. Like,
Yeah, I was like, yeah, I was that guy. No, honestly, though, I really love it, though, because the fact that it's become mainstream, I've always felt like this is just a healthier way to train. And so the fact that it's popular enough now that it there's like, memes and jokes about it, and it's kind of like it's a household term. The fact that people can riff off it now, I'm like, this has been like the dream with all this all along.
I've just seen a lot of those, and I'm like, yep, that is exactly how I feel at the moment, for sure.
No matter what, that whatever you do, everything you get excited about, there's definitely someone out there who's better than you are at it.
And, I mean,
No question.
for sure, if you're trying to do multiple things at once, you're going to be in that
Oh,
camp.
yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, oh, you've
Cool.
been doing this for a couple of years and you're better than I am after doing it for eight. That's fine.
Well, that's happening now too. Or yeah, that's happening now too. Just getting into the cardio side of things and being like, oh yeah, like feeling good about it myself. But once I'm like entering into the world of people who run, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm pretty dog shit at this still, you know? Which is all good. So for the listener, we're going to introduce, listen, I have some other podcasts with Alyssa Olenek and a friend of mine, Brian Borstein, who talk about some zone two stuff. But I just feel like even if there's a bit of overlap in our discussion today, I just think that you have a way of putting things. We're going to talk about different stuff than I talked about with them on their podcasts. But you have a way of saying things that I think even if we had the same podcast, I think there'd be good things to take away. But we're going to talk about the just introduction to the zones. When people say zone three, zone five, zone two, whatever, what are we talking about? We'll riff on zone two. And then we are going to talk about some sub-threshold work you could call kind of zone three stuff. And maybe I didn't even do this in the notes that I sent you. I mean, I think some people that are in this space are just dipped their toe and have heard about polarized training and maybe some misconceptions about the application of polarized training versus like sweet spot stuff, pyramidal stuff. And depends how much time we have, how much we get through. But so we'll talk intro to zones, talk zone two, we'll talk zone three. And then I do want to make sure we save time at the end for the practical application side of this, where they're like, the average, the person who's listening to my podcast probably coming from the lifting side. And so they might be here thinking, okay, I already lift. I'd love to integrate some cardio into my life. And maybe from a minimum effective dose standpoint of I want to do this for health, or maybe somebody with slightly more ambitious performance goals. We'll talk a little bit through those two scenarios towards the end. Sound good?
Sounds good. Let's do it.
Cool, man. Let's do an introduction to the zones. What are the zones? Let's talk about maybe a couple different zone systems and anything important you feel that distinguishes one from the other in terms of which you might use.
Cool. Yeah, I think so. The zone system, I think it's important to remember that, like a lot of things in endurance, the zone system kind of arrived from early just empirical observation, just working with runners like, 100 years ago and looking at different kind of intensities. The zones was back then was actually more of a very subjective sort of thing. Oh, well, okay, this is kind of easy work, and this work you do for a little bit less time, and this is harder work, so let's start dividing it. The idea of like using hard metrics like heart rate and so forth to divide it, it's kind of like this evolved at the same time as endurance training. And it's kind of an interesting thing to me when looking at the history of endurance training, how many old ideas are not scientifically based at all, but evolved in parallel with the science. So they're scientific, but they're not, there's still a lot of stuff that we believe in endurance training that really needs to change. But so the whole zone idea is just a way of categorizing intensities that gives you they're designed to give you an idea of what you can expect from each bucket, how long you can do it for, and what it's going to take out of you. Like what it's going to give you and what it's going to take out of you. And that's kind of where we use it. And there's three zone systems, there's five zone systems, there's seven zone systems. You've got people coming up with multiple ones. And I think you and I mostly use the file.
Yeah, I want to say something for the listener. I think that this is something I find myself. I'll talk for 5 minutes with a client and then I'll go back and say this. So I'm going to say it now. When you use the word intensity, what we mean is in this, we're going to use running, by the way. We're going to talk a lot about cardio in this podcast. And zone, when it comes to zones and a lot of the philosophies around training are modality agnostic. So if I say the word running, I promise I just mean any modality, right? So when we say intensity, we mean how hard you're working, or how fast you're running, or how fast you're rowing, how many watts you're putting out, or watts on a bike, or watts on a rower. We don't mean how hard a workout is. And I think that that's a common misconception. I'll say to clients, hey, this is some higher intensity work that, and we're going to run faster in these workouts. That doesn't mean that that workout is harder. So when you say intensity, what you're meaning, and you could chew it up and spit it out, you mean how fast are is the work interval, work portion of this workout going to be?
Exactly. It's like, it's like intensity. We're saying kind of like the percentage of your one rep max. It doesn't mean that it's harder. It just means it's a higher load, or in this case, like more power output, faster pace, whatever else.
Cool, good. And because I think we're going to say higher intensity, lower intensity, and that I wouldn't say it's inverse, where like higher intensity workouts are actually easier, but you could, in some ways they are. And so, in some ways, like you and I just finished wrapping up 800 meter training and did a lot of sprint work, and those, that's really high intense running, where we were running very, very fast sprinting, but with long rest periods under low fatigue without cumulative fatigue over the workout. So those workouts weren't more challenging, even though they were done at a higher intensity. I think people need to just remember, just because you're doing higher intensity, meaning you're running faster, or putting out more watts on a bike, or a row or something, it doesn't necessarily mean that that workout is overall, from like an RPE standpoint, harder.
It's a little bit like, powerlifting versus bodybuilding. Powerlifters can spend 2.5 hours at the gym and they'll do one heavy lift every 10 minutes and eat gummy worms in between. I love powerlifting. I'm not ripping on anybody. But sometimes, they go through a bodybuilding workout and you're just hitting one set after another. And you're like, oh, this is really lightweight. But after like your fourth set and you're exhausted. So yeah, same kind of thing.
Do we want to look at a like do you put one of the zones? So you said there's a three zone. You could do a three zone system, you could do a five zone system, you could do a seven zone system. Do you, and for the most part, you and I together have done a zone, have worked, have communicated with a zone five system. But do you feel one is much better than the other? Would you sit here making a play of like, yeah, I make a pitch to somebody that the zone five system's better, or is there even a talking point here of like, yeah, I suggest people do this for a certain reason?
I think it's actually really important to know that there are good arguments for all of them, because every now and then, if you're just getting into this space, sometimes you'll see that some authors, and in some countries even, like a three zone system is more common. And the reason this is important, just as an aside, is there was an article that came out a while ago about a runner, a very well-known ultra runner, who does a lot of his work in zone one. And a lot of people are like, wow, that's kind of crazy. But if you look at the fact that in some cases this is with a three zone system, you're going, oh, well, wait a minute, that's kind of zone one and two for us, so we don't want to get the wrong idea. I like the five zone system because it gives five really good buckets that I think are actionable. Because I think, you and I have had some discussions on the higher intensity stuff and why it's kind of important to distinguish between that whole like zone four and zone five. And there's differences in how you describe it. So I think I like the five.
Let's stay with the five then, and let's talk about what each zone means in terms of anchored to something physiologically, like what actually marks the end of a zone, the beginning of another. And I will say that while we are going to go into that, my follow-up question will be, do people need to be thinking about it that much? Just because those kind of anchored the zones are in some degree anchored to certain physiological things, doesn't necessarily mean everyone needs to be super obsessed with that. So I don't want you people, the listener, to get ahead of yourself thinking you need to know all of these demarcations where this happens. But for the sake of learning and understanding, could we walk through kind of, okay, zone one is physiologically speaking up to this point. Zone two is physiologically up to this point. Three, four, five, et cetera. How might you go about distinguishing each zone?
So usually the way I go through it is I say like zone one is pretty much anything from, the moment you stand up to a fast walk. And I will say zone one is anything where your body does not have to really disrupt its homeostasis. I usually say that zone one ends when you feel like you have to start breathing deeper to actually continue moving. Like if you're just going for a walk with your dog and you're just, you're breathing normally, I'd say that's zone one. If you start going for a fast walk though, you might start to notice that You start to breathe a little bit more heavily. You're like, oh, I'm actually working. You might even feel like tiny little beads of sweat coming on your forehead on a hot day. To me, that's the difference between zone one and zone two. And I think from a physiological level, it's a little fuzzier. People say, well, is there really like a heart rate difference? And people put an arbitrary thing. I usually just say, look, the distinction between that is anything zone one, you don't really consider exercise, you just consider movement. And you can do it all day. You don't even think twice about it. It's an easy stroll. Zone two is where that, deeper breathing starts, and you're like, okay, I'm actually doing exercise now. I probably don't want to wear street clothes for this. I feel like I'm actually working. And that intensity goes all the way up to what you and I always discuss as like the VT1. And if you want me to start going into that, I even say like, really what happens at the top end of zone two is when you're in zone two, when you're in that level, your body is constantly like, your muscles are producing carbon dioxide and you're trying to do the gas exchange and everything else. Up to the top of zone two, your body, just by breathing a little bit deeper, is able to keep those carbon dioxide levels under control and everything else. And everything is still very, very aerobic in the body. There's a lot of fat burning going on. There's not a lot of metabolite buildup. Your body is like, hey, this is still pretty easy. We're not burning a lot of muscle glycogen. We can keep doing this. When you get to the top of zone two, the biggest change you're going to notice is that no longer is just breathing deeper enough. Your respiration rate starts to increase. So you'll notice that at high zone two, you can probably carry on a conversation. You're going to be breathing deeply, but you can carry on a conversation. That ventilatory threshold one, we usually use the TOC test to measure when you're past that. And it's with under that level, you can say like a 15, 20 word sentence without too much trouble. When you get beyond that, you're going to notice a real break where suddenly, if you try just breathing deep, you're going to feel like, oh my God, I need to take a breath. That's usually the sign that what's happening at that point is there's enough carbon dioxide buildup in your body and everything else that all your systems are sending a signal to your brain like, hey, we've got to pick up the breathing rate a little bit here to, keep buffering out all this stuff. We're working a little bit harder. There's a little more glycogen being burned. There's some more anaerobic metabolism going on. Hey, we're in a slightly higher stress mode. So that's VT1. That is the top of zone two. So anytime we talk about zone two, we're talking about less than that, which most people realize is deceptively easy. And I think you and I have discussed multiple times, like, hey, for some people, zone two, they're not going to be able to run. The moment they start running, they're like, hey, no, I'm in zone three. I can't pass the talk test when I'm running. That's a lot of people.
Yep.
And so, yeah, and I think that's one thing that I think is still, no matter how much you say it, people will still be like, no, that can't be right. Like I can jog easily, and they'll start jogging, and they realize that, oh no, I'm actually in zone three, even if you're in pretty good shape. So zone three is that whole level past that point. And that goes all the way up to what is a fuzzy line because there are so many different ways of expressing the top of zone three. And you and I talk about the second ventilatory threshold, the lactate threshold, all that. From a scientific standpoint, the way I really think about that level there is through all of zone three, your body is pretty much capable of keeping everything under control. There's anaerobic stuff going on, your muscle cells are producing some waste products and everything else, but your body is still pretty adequately, keeping everything stable. Your waste products are being cleaned up as fast as they're being produced, and the system's working harder and harder and harder. When you get to that threshold, your body is not able to keep all that stuff under control. And in labs, you hear people call it lactate threshold and say, past that point, lactate levels rise and all that. And I think the reason why you and I don't really focus on that is because, A, lactate is not the enemy, it's not a waste product. So it kind of seems deceptive. And also, that's not a really practical way to measure it because lactate levels are different depending on what you do. So even lactate tests might not be useful. And at the end of the day, we're not going to sit there testing our blood lactate. So we typically just call that the threshold. And the biggest thing you'll notice there is when you get past zone three, for most people, that's like between their 5 and 10K pace. It's just figure like 40 minutes worth of work. When you get past that, you're going to notice that every incremental increase in speed is like there's a ticking clock going. And I think that's, kind of when we're telling people to visualize it, just say, okay, like, that intensity. When you're over that, and you can feel your legs start to get tired really quickly. And you feel your heart rate is still climbing. And you're like, wow, I'm no longer thinking I can do this for an hour. I'm thinking I've got 20 minutes at most. It's a pretty notable delineation the more you train it. So that's the top of zone three there. That's the threshold that we talk about. And again, for most people, it's like, hey, here was my best 5K, and I think here's my best 10K. I'm like, okay, that's probably the pace of somewhere in between there. So that's a zone three. It's a little bit harder to test, like just telling someone to go out and run a hard 5K is sometimes a big ask. So it's kind of a you kind of got to feel it out a little bit.
Yeah, that's super
So
helpful. Go ahead.
yeah.
Let's keep going.
So yeah. So going up from that, now we talk about zone four. So zone four is anything that's faster than that. But we already know that when you're in zone four, since you're kind of that, ticking clock, sand in the hourglass running out, you can't spend a lot of time up there. The faster you go, the less time you have up there. Zone four is anything that's just considered that kind of speed work. And a lot of stuff falls into zone four. Like a 5K is in zone four, technically. You're running it at that. If you are military and you're running a 3 mile test or even a 1.5 mile test, that's all zone four work. Zone four tops out, and this is where I think the other distinction is useful. Zone four tops out at what I consider the VVO2 max pace. So what that means to everybody is we're all familiar with, have heard probably the terms VO2 max. We know that that's the most oxygen that your body can use at any time, which is kind of an arbitrary figure. But that's kind of like, okay, anything past zone four, because between zone three and zone four, your muscles can still use more oxygen. They're producing a lot of waste products, but they're still using incrementally more oxygen. At zone four, right before zone five, you go beyond that and you can't use any more oxygen. You're at your limit there. So everything above that is where all that power is coming from is pure anaerobic stuff, pure lactate generation and utilization, and it's all anaerobic. So, and why I think that's important is anything in zone five, like, you're not taxing your aerobic system anymore at that. And I think that's why it's really useful, because when we talk about, people wanting to do like speed work and, what do I do to make myself faster? Anything in zone five is going to be just anaerobic. And I think, I mean, and that's something we can measure as well. So when we measure that, we use like the 8 minute all out test. See how far you can go in 8 minutes, and your average pace in that is probably your VVO2 max. So that's the other number. It's not super easy to test for. It's going to be a little bit slower than your 1 mile pace. That's pretty much what I say. So, and
There's a ton there, obviously. And I appreciate you going through it because I know as you're making some of these distinctions, I can hear it in your voice and just knowing from working with you that there are certain points along the way that maybe implicate training a bit more than others and certain distinctions of, well, is this heart rate or it's, that it's, this point where lactate kicks up or there's certain things that we end up that implicate training a bit more than others. So just a quick, let me just spit back kind of what you said and see if I have it. So we have zone one. Yes, people get a little bit bent out of shape when we call zone one not exercise. Hold on, I'm not, but I think we're just speaking objectively about intensities here. And zone one is just really easy, not challenging, walking my dog. And that's great. And I think that if you want to just call that really ridiculously easy exercise, fine. If you want to make a distinction and say, hey, that's movement that's, not gonna get your heart rate up, you're not gonna get huffy and puffy. You could literally do that forever. There's almost infinite amount of time you could be doing zone one. Then, okay, let's not get bent out of shape semantically. I think it's totally fine. I would agree that calling zone one as movement, and just to make that distinction semantically, it helps me in my brain. Zone two is when we're actually starting to work and as much like that you're going to call this like a real cardio session, nobody's calling walking their dog a cardio session. Technically everything's cardio just on a spectrum of intensities, but I don't mind that distinction PS. So zone two is a pace that feels roughly infinitely sustainable, but harder than zone one. It's not actually infinitely sustainable. Nothing really is, of course. And we're kind of marking out the top of that. And we're going to talk about this a lot more. So if I'm glossing over it now, because we're about to dive into zone two a ton, where you can't really keep a conversation anymore. You try and say 10 to 15 words, and you got to do kind of that sort of catch up breath in the middle. And again, we'll talk about can we can, what other proxies can we use to kind of triangulate in my end zone two? We'll get there. Then we have zone three, which is anything above that. And zone three, I might categorize as is harder but still sustainable, meaning like, I'm doing it and I know I'm working hard, but I know I can keep doing this. And almost where zone three becomes zone four is The minute I start working in zone four, I see the light at the end of the tunnel. Like I see that I'm not going to keep this up.
Yeah,
I know
exactly.
the second I start running at that pace, I'm feeling way more cognizant that the end is near, right? And so zone four, right? Zone four, the top of zone four being VVO2 max, maybe in that like 8 to 10 minute max effort range. Again, like something I've learned from working is that like if you can do something for 10 minutes all out, like your life depends on it. Sometimes even doing that same pace for 1 minute is really challenging. And so it feels really challenging. And so when I'm thinking about zone four, I'm thinking about a pace that I know is not like I would not give it any version of the word sustainable. I would say there's a ticking time, there's a clock on this the minute I start running here. And then a distinction that has been powerful for me in learning this is the top of zone four into zone five is where it shifts from, and this is where one of the just many kind of analogies from lifting to running has been helpful. Where zone five is characterized by failure via neuromuscular fatigue. And it's essentially saying, like, yeah, if you're in zone five, the thing that's going to have you stop running is on the neuromuscular side of things, the local muscle metabolism side, not your aerobic system. And so an analogy might be like, okay, if we're doing a lift and you're doing, let's say, a compound lift or you're doing a squat, and someone's like, hey, what muscle group got the best stimulus? You can kind of say, well, which muscle was taken to failure? Which muscle was the cause of the cessation of that set? That's the muscle that got the best stimulus. And so when we're looking at zone five, I think both of us would say, okay, there's an aerobic component there to some degree, but the thing that caused failure was your muscles. And so we can almost make a distinction of that's no longer, again, if you're going to call zone one movement, I'm calling zone five not cardio, right? And so it is, and we're just like a little tongue in cheek there, but that distinction of like, oh, once we're in zone five, it's almost like zone five is you're going to fail via your muscles before, let's say, being able to hit max heart rate or before being able to take your cardiovascular system to the point where it's the thing that causes you to slow down. And so if we are saying in general, hey, the thing that gets taken to failure or close to failure or the thing that causes you to stop the set is the thing that got the best stimulus. In this case, zone five would be talking about neuromuscular adaptations getting, let's say the best stimulus. Is that fair?
I would definitely say so. And I mean, I think the thing is to anyone listening who goes, well, there's got to be a heavy aerobic component too. There absolutely is. I mean, you were training for the 800. I don't think anybody could tell you that your cardiovascular system didn't feel taxed when you were running that 800. So it's not that it's not getting worked, but like you said, it's not the limiting factor. And I think why that's important is because when we're, and everything we talk about training, we got to make sure that each type of training that we do is really has a specific target. We can't just throw stuff at a wall and see what sticks and be like, ah, this is working a little bit of everything. Like we train to get good at specific things. So that's where the distinction really comes in useful.
And then we mentioned a word that I think people are also starting to hear more is lactate threshold. And I think you drop the lactate from that a little, which I like, just in an attempt to simplify it a little bit and not necessarily anchor it to something that most people are never going to go into a lab and do some crazy, or they prick their finger at home every couple of minutes or whatever. So just calling it threshold, and saying that it's a, if someone's like, hey, what's your lactate threshold or whatever, like what they're actually saying is like a pace or power that you could hold for, again, somewhere between 30 and 60 minutes. It depends on the modality and the athlete for sure. You had mentioned somewhere between your 5K pace and your 10K pace. Again, like that each of those might mean more and be more helpful to somebody where like maybe you haven't run a 5 or 10K pace, but oh, I could keep this up for 30 minutes. How much do you, you know what? We're going to get there in a second. Because what we're talking about, we're going to head over to zone two now and we're going to dive deep on it. And then we're going to shift to a discussion essentially on zone three, and why I would say that working with you, this has been the zone three has been the most fascinating thing that I've learned and taken with me and actually maybe had the biggest impact on my ability to get better given the things that I prioritize in my life. And so I think that that's an interesting because a lot of people think, zone two, they hear, the top athletes in the world do a ton of zone two, and people hear that like jogging is bad. You should be sprinting or doing zone two or sprinting or zone two. And this kind of middle ground is just like middle ground where you get less of everything. It's like, turns out, yeah, you get injured, you're just jogging and your cortisol goes up, your test goes down or whatever other bullshit people are saying about This about jogging gets a bad rap. I feel like sprinting is like this, like whatever. We can go into this another time, but it's like this, like everybody on this, their like hashtag primal ancestral diet is like, oh yeah, we got to sprint like our ancestors, or just none of this low intensity stuff. And I feel like in the middle there is jogging kind of being like, am I like that meme where it's like, he don't see me? Like what about me? You know? So I have been fascinated by our utilization of zone 3. And so I'm looking forward to chatting about that. So yeah, we're gonna do zone 2 first, just, you know, numerical chronological order here. So let's talk about zone 2. Let me see what I put in our notes. We went a little bit over what it is and what sorts of physiological like markers matter. And you had mentioned more of a ventilatory threshold, more looking at, you know, your breath rate and what your cadence is and what your ability to maintain a conversation is like. What are some other proxies for I'm in zone 2? Because I think even I, who's been doing this for quite some time, the talk test can be a little vague, right? You know, in some ways it is and it isn't. I think if you're well beyond zone 2, then you know I can't keep a conversation. But there's going to be people out there that are like, I hear everyone talk about the talk test, and then I start doing this incline walk, and I'm still not sure if I'm in the right place. So how can I either improve my understanding of the talk test so I can use it as a tool? But what are some other things I can think about to triangulate if I'm in zone 2?
So one of the things some people do, and this has been used in so many other ways, but breathing through your nose is often used by some people as a throttle control. And one of the reasons for that is one of the other triggers when you start to cross that ventilatory threshold is you move from nasal breathing to oral nasal breathing to oral breathing. And some people, that shift starts right about at zone 2. So if you can still breathe through your nose, and this is, you know, not during cold and flu season where you'll be shooting snot rockets everywhere, but if you can still breathe through your nose, chances are you haven't crossed into zone 3 yet. It might seem a little bit labored, but part of the reason for that is the aperture size in your nose is obviously relatively small. And most of us, unless we bought into the whole like I must nasal breathe for everything shenanigans, you know, we have this pretty potent drive to start breathing through our mouth as well once we cross that first ventilatory threshold. So it's almost not even like, can I breathe through my nose? But it's like, hey, do I feel uncomfortable trying to breathe through my nose here? That's usually one indication that our body is saying, no, you have to breathe faster than this. This is not adequate. So that's one other one I use.
Well, let's talk about heart rate. I mean, is it something that is that some? I mean, listen, this is going to be the one. Everyone's got an Apple Watch. Everyone's got a Garmin. Everyone's got some wearable. They have access to that data. Is that something that they should, you know, if we were listing these, and again, they're all going to be things that we use to triangulate our intensity. Do you rank the utilization of heart rate very high? Do you rank it a little bit lower? And if we're going to use that at all for zone 2, what would be the, you know, rough elevator, you know, hey, this is how you know you're in zone 2 if you use heart rate.
And you know, honestly, so, and that's one of the reasons it's so hard to use because there's even debate on that. Is it 65 to 70%? Is it 68% to 73%? Like it would always range, but usually say, look, around 70% of your max heart rate is usually a pretty good proxy for it. I think the reason why I tend to rank heart rate a little bit lower, though, is because two things. First of all, the whole 220 minus age to come up with your max heart rate, it's accurate, but accurate within the standard human population, within one standard deviation, we're talking like plus or minus 8 beats per minute. Two standard deviations means plus or minus like 16 beats per minute. We're talking about a pretty big range and still what's considered normal. Like, you know, my max heart rate theoretically is 176. It could be anywhere between actually 185 and 160. And that's still a normal range for my age.
So, can I pause
So,
you for a sec? So, you're saying so a lot of these heart rate metrics to assess zones are percents of max heart rate, and max heart rate will just vary so much from individual. Even if 220 minus age is decent back of the envelope math, and you might be able to get, you know, all right, ballpark it. You're saying we're making, you know, first of all, we can't even agree on the percent of max heart rate, and then there's just a wide enough distribution of on an individual level where you land in terms of how well your actual max heart rate matches up with the 220 minus age calculation. That, you know, we have two moving parts there that together make it a bit gray.
exactly. And I think what the reason I don't want people to get too stuck on that is because, you know, also the other thing is max heart rate varies depending on your modality. Your max heart rate when you're running can be different than your max heart rate when you're on a bike, which can be different than your max heart rate on an air bike. So since it's different for all those things, because you're using a different number of muscles and everything else, and your heart is trying to get oxygen to the working muscles, you have fewer working muscles, it's not going to have to pump as fast. It gets confusing for people, which is why I'm like, hey, look, if we can use something a little bit more subjective that you can feel, that's probably more accurate. But if you do know your maximum heart rate, or you have a pretty good idea, and you want to take 70% of that and think, okay, this is a good starting point, and then
Would
you
you say
see how.
70%? Would you say 70% as the top end of zone two, or 70% as like a maybe middle of the ground? It's a smidge higher, you're probably still zone two. A smidge lower, you're probably still zone two.
I think that's kind of a nice middle of the ground. Again, it's like one of these things where how much precision do we want to apply to something that's kind of inherently a little bit imprecise?
Sure.
But
What if
yeah,
you
that's what's
you
in it.
wanted to find out your max heart rate and so say, hey, I'm willing to put in X amount of time and effort to find my max heart rate, and then that cancels out one of these moving parts of one of these variables that we're not sure about, then okay, like maybe we can't agree if it's 75 or 70 or 65 or 62 or 72, but I at least know this number. And if I take all of those recommendations that people have mentioned, people or experts are saying, oh, it's this, then at least I can get a little bit closer. How might somebody go about finding their max heart rate?
Max heart rate test, it's very often what people will do is they'll do something that is roughly equivalent to about a 5K, and then at the very end run 400 meters all out. And that's usually like a protocol like that will get you pretty close. Run it 20 minutes at your 5K pace, assuming that your 5K is longer than 20 minutes, and then run 400 meters all out where your heart rate tops out, will probably be pretty close to it.
Yeah,
There are
run a
a couple of ways.
5K and give me a good kick at the end.
Yeah, exactly. And that'll probably touch up on it pretty well. So,
That's pretty practical.
yeah, I think it is. But of course, it's like with so many of these things, so much of that depends on like individual motivation. That's one of the reasons why like VO2 max testing is such a mess, because individual motivation to push yourself that hard, it's not always there. So,
Yeah, that's true. I've had we're going to talk about threshold in a bit, but I've had clients do our kind of pseudo. Again, trying not to murder people, threshold test of like a 20-minute max effort, and then I will find that in the subsequent months of training that having used, let's say, 90% of that, which we'll talk about in a bit, that they outperform that, and it's different if I have them go into a local town turkey trot and really push themselves. It's slightly different. So, and I've learned firsthand the difference between pushing yourself in training and being out there on race day. So yeah, so if you want to know your max heart rate, go run a 5K and push yourself really, really hard. And chances are that's good enough for you to take that number and be closer and make 70% of that number as a proxy for zone two a more useful target.
Because it's a little bit like, hey, you go out there and you say, look, the highest I've ever seen out there is 160. And 220 minus 80 just gives you a measure of 190, and you're going, okay, I don't think that I was underperforming that much during that 5K. Mine is probably a little bit lower than 190, so I'm gonna set something a little bit more conservative here. Take 70% of that, see how I feel. If that seems to pass the talk test, and I kind of go, oh, cool, I've got my numbers. That's close enough. And I think that's kind of a lot of stuff here is just kind of like test and recalibrate and adjust as you go on.
I think, tell me if you think this is a crazy way of doing this. So what we have is we have the talk test, we have percent, we have heart rate, we have maybe general subjective RPE, and maybe we haven't necessarily given like a number that people might be looking for from RPE. We have a subjective understanding that this should be a pace that's harder than walking, but still not so hard that I can probably keep this up for 2 hours. If you're like, hey, you got to do this, you have to do this for 2 hours, like you should confidently say yes. I usually tell people that at the end of a zone two session, you're probably closer to bored than you are exhausted. It's, it's not that you're not fatigued at all. Totally. You should be, but like I'm almost more looking forward to going to do something else than I am to like sitting down, let's say.
I've actually worked with a client who ADHD, and he says, literally, if I skip my Vyvanse, I can't get through my zone two sessions because I get bored. And I'm like, okay, that's actually pretty telling, because he's working, but he's just like, after an hour, I start thinking about the other things I got to do. Like, okay, cool, that was the zone two.
So I might suggest somebody who's like, okay, like cool, like we have objective markers that are accessible to people, and I say objective in air quotes as heart rate because it's objective what your heart rate is, but not necessarily objective where it should be. But that data is like readily accessible for most people on their wrist or chest strap or whatever. So would you say, okay, person X, you do the 220 minus age, do 70% of that, find an intensity that gets you in that ballpark, and then almost at that point, start to assess subjectiveness. I'm not saying it needs to be in chronological order of like, hey, do the heart rate first, but it's almost like something to anchor to, where it's like, hey, get yourself, before you start testing yourself with the subjective measures, because maybe you're not really great at assessing those, or maybe you're just, you're looking for something more to latch onto that's a more objective. Can you say, all right, let's get you to that 70% max heart rate, and then let's start to say, how do I feel? What's this feel like? You know, and you can learn a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to go about it as well, because I think some people do get concerned. They're like, I have no idea what this talk test feels like. I don't know if I'm going too hard. I don't know if I'm going too easy. Well, they start going at 70% of their predicted heart rate, they go, oh, okay, like this is a little harder than I thought I would go. And they start talking and they go, okay, yeah, I can still get out that, you know, two sentences in a row. It feels hard, but all right, that's what zone two should feel like.
Cool. Yeah, let's I'm looking at time. I'm like, I just want to make sure I know we have some more than an hour, but we can do an entire podcast on zone two. So I'll speed us up when I feel like it's time to speed up. I'll ask you for more of a rapid fire, but let's go through the benefits of zone two. And I think there's some nuance to even how you would describe that. Let's talk about, hey, if someone's like, hey, what are the benefits of zone two? What are you saying?
Benefits of zone two. You can do a lot of it. It tends to be really well tolerated. The recovery cost of it is pretty minimal. So if you're doing a lot of zone two, you are probably not going to be super sore. You can do it. You can do zone two work at the end of a workout. You can do it the day before a lift. And since it's so well tolerated and not likely to beat you up, it is easy to integrate into the rest of your program. It's a little bit, I don't want to say it's a free lunch because everything costs something, but it's one of those kinds of training that you can do a lot of it with minimal disruption. The biggest thing is just, you know, make sure you eat enough, because, you know, it's burning calories. But that's one of the biggest benefits. There are a lot of cardiovascular benefits to it. It is still the type of training, just in terms of, like, you know, glucose disposal and insulin control and improving, you know, the strength of your entire heart, the eccentric hypertrophy we talk about, you know, vascular elasticity, stroke volume in your heart, all of those things. It is great for all of those. So it is just, it's great for general health. It's great for performance, and it's really easily tolerated, which I think all put together is why you're like, hey, anybody can do it. You can do it almost anytime you want. And it's going to give you so many health and performance benefits that that's why people love it.
Yeah. We throw on there, or I'll throw on there, at least like throw on there because of what people may have come across at some point, like mitochondrial health, and, you know, as in kind of a vague answer, but also, you know, air quote metabolic flexibility as well. But I have you on the podcast for this exact reason, because the first thing out of your mouth when I ask you about a benefit of zone two is that you said you can do a lot of it. It's not that tiring. And you can add it to potentially other stuff you're doing without risking fatigue very much. And I think that is at the crux of a lot of what I've learned from you about zone two. And maybe, so I'll paint a picture for you. Zone two became all the rage, you know, just maybe, I don't know, in the last couple of years, you know, people looking more at what professional runners and people in the Tour de France are doing. And, you know, Inigo San Milan goes on a podcast with Peter Attia, and the whole world thinks they have to be doing a ton of zone two now. And got to absolutely be burning fat to get better at burning fat. You got to be, you know, doing zone two to improve mitochondrial biogenesis and all this stuff. And what it feels like from the outside looking in is that zone two does those things uniquely, that those are benefits unique to zone two. And that if you go into zone three, that you get a different list of benefits, but you don't get these. And so what I felt at the end of that, and I'm going to use that podcast with Inigo San Milan and Peter Attia, because I think that that's where a lot of people in this space sort of latched onto this training or doing zone two training. And I got a lot of people that from that were really worried that they were like, oh, I might be over zone two and I'm not getting those benefits. So do you look at it as, hey, those are unique benefits to zone two, or would you maybe frame that otherwise?
You know, I think when we talked about, you know, a little bit about like sprinting and, you know, neurological limiting factors versus aerobic limiting, it's not that higher than zone two doesn't train these things at all. It's just that at higher intensities, you might not be able to max out as much adaptation as you can get to maximize these things. So Basically, what this is saying, if you do nothing but zone two, you could probably do 20 hours a week of zone two, spread out and maximize your cardiovascular benefits and, metabolic flexibility and da, 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 da. The moment you start doing more intense work, you can handle less of it. So even though you're getting all these other benefits from the higher stuff, from the higher intensity stuff, you can't do as much because some of those things aren't necessarily linearly intensity related. So put it another way, if I could do 20 hours of zone two a week, I might only be able to do a 5 hours of zone three a week. And within that, even though that zone three work probably has really profound benefits, I am not getting the same gross benefits to some of those systems as that zone two work would do, just because that zone two work crosses that critical amount of time. So I think where that becomes most important, though, is when you're looking at a system where somebody has that time to burn. If you have 3 hours a week and you do 3 hours of zone two versus 3 hours of zone three, your net benefit to those systems is probably going to be the same, if not more profound, in the zone three group. It's just harder to program and recover from and everything else. So I think it's kind of like, all right, to get that minimum effective dose, for most of us, we're trying to get people just to get out there and do anything minimally disruptive. Zone two gives you a lot of really good stuff and it's easy to do. When you start going more intense, you're limiting how much you can do, which for some people might lead them to do a lot less. And so it's not that you don't get those benefits. If I go out and I sprint for 10 seconds, I'm still getting some of those benefits of zone two. It's just such a small amount that it's not relevant. So that's kind of the main distinction is, yeah, it's not like those things suddenly turn off as you go more intense. They're still there. There's just other costs.
I'm imagining a five circle Venn diagram of quite a bit of overlap between them, and slivers of uniqueness to each of them, but a lot of overlap to them. And in lifting, there's people who listen to the podcast may have heard this terminology before, but I'll explain it. Is stimulus to fatigue ratio is basically the amount of benefit of something I'm getting to the ratio of how tiring it is. And something that has a good stimulus to fatigue ratio means I can do a lot of it, benefit from a lot of it, and it's not that tiring relative to the amount of benefit I'm getting. And so I would say, like you said, the benefit of zone two is it has an amazing SFR, meaning you can do a lot of it, benefit from a lot of it, and it's not that tiring. But the most important, not most important, whatever, the R ratio in SFR points to the fact that, and I'll give a lifting analogy for my lifting folks here. Like if I told you that you could get a better stimulus to fatigue ratio training two reps shy of failure, and you're only training twice a week, and you hear me say that, and you're like, cool, I'm going to lift with two reps in the tank. It's like, well, you're not doing that much total work. So you don't necessarily really need to manage fatigue as much. And even if training all the way to failure got you a little bit more stimulus, but a lot more fatigue, it still might be the right thing for you because you're not doing that much work. So you might not need to worry about the ratio so much. You might need to do the thing that gets you more stimulus. And so I see that being a common misconception here. And we're going to come back to stuff like, can women benefit from zone two? We're going to come to stuff with, do I have to stay in zone two the whole time? Some of these questions that I had people ask me because they knew you were coming on. But one of the biggest things that I've learned from you is that, like when you look at pro athletes who do a lot of zone two training, that doesn't apply to Greg, who wants to do cardio twice a week for general health. Now, that doesn't mean, because the reason it doesn't apply to him, to be thorough here, is because if you're not doing that much overall, then you're at less risk of overdoing it. And so you don't necessarily need to worry about the fatigue as much. And I want to be clear. People have regular lives. Sometimes that lives are stressful and your stress bucket is full and you do need to worry about training related fatigue. Totally. But I just think that people are like, oh, Kipchoge and Pogacar do a lot of zone two training. I should do a lot of zone two. It's like, no, dude, you have 1 hour of lifting. You have 1 hour of cardio a week. Like you should be doing something that gets more stimulus per minute and worrying a little bit less about the fatigue because you're just not doing as much overall. So to summarize, and then we can move on a little bit. I would say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the biggest benefit of zone two is that it has a really good SFR and you can add it to your lifting. You can add it to other stuff you're doing without much worry that it's going to fatigue you a whole lot. And if you are an advanced runner, then it is the knob that can be turned really, really high in terms of time spent there without a big worry of the fatigue component.
So another analogy that I would think of is picture like higher intensity work as like really dense vegetables, like leafy greens and vegetables in your diet. And think of zone two as like white rice. Now, vegetables have carbohydrates, they've got protein, they've got a lot of other good stuff. And if you're not eating very much, you can eat a lot of vegetables and get all the carbs and protein you need. But if your energy needs go way up, you're not going to be able to get that from vegetables. You're going to fill up. There are going to be other limiting factors that stop you from getting it. So you need to eat a lot of other simple carbs. If you're an elite athlete and you're taking in 5,000 calories a day, you're going to lay out a lot of easy carbs. So does it is it that the easy carbs have anything that the vegetables don't? No. You just are not going to get the required dose from vegetables. If you're only eating 1,000 calories a day, you probably can eat a lot of vegetables. You don't need to fill up on all that white rice. So it's a little bit like that. It's kind of like, all right, it's really good for you, but it's also pretty dense and you can't eat that much. So, like you said, the knob we can turn up in a high calorie diet is carbs. There you go. Boom.
So th we're going to get to a practical example of like a person who's lifting and wants to add cardio. But in short, to summarize before we move on from this, it is not the case that zone two is this unique, all-powerful thing that should be the first thing everybody adds because it has a magical power. If you're not doing a lot of something, it's okay to do something that is a little bit more fatiguing for a little bit more benefit. You don't need to optimize SFR if you're not doing that much.
Right, exactly. Agreed.
Cool. And we're going to come back to some of the dichotomy between zone two and zone three in terms of application in a bit. Let's do some. I'm going to list a couple of things. Some reasons that you there's I think there's a lot of hype around zone two. Maybe things that we hear in the space. Some of them are maybe my opinions. And you're going to do the strongly disagree, kind of disagree, kind of agree to strongly agree. And then you can riff on it a bit if you think that that's important. And we kind of just covered this one. The first one was, because it provides unique benefits you can't get otherwise. And I think we, it's kind of like, yes, it has a, in that visual Venn diagram of benefit, there is something unique to zone two, totally, but it's not the case that it is, it's standing alone as a circle in that graphic. Yeah, we'll move on with that. We beat that one to dead to death here. So next one is because it is the fat burning zone. And that means that I will burn more fat off my body versus other intensities that use carbohydrates.
Strongly disagree. And just because, yes, as a percentage, it burns more fat, but in terms of absolute levels, higher intensity is going to burn more fat. And at the end of the day, unless you're doing a whole lot, we're not too worried about you draining all your carbohydrates anyway. So, yeah, there's no magical fat burning zone.
Can you talk about actually, so there's no magical fat burning zone. So quickly, if you're working at lower intensities, your body might use more fat for fuel, but that doesn't actually equate to a net loss in body fat, which is only achievable through being in a calorie deficit. And but you had mentioned, hey, but if you're in higher intensities, you actually burn more fat, which I think is a kind of like a skeptical eyebrow moment if somebody hears that. What do you mean by that? Because I think that that's actually a funny way of countering that argument kind of right off the bat. It's like actually zone three burns more fat. What do you mean by that?
Rate of fat oxidation, the amount of fat being burned per minute goes up as intensity goes up pretty linearly. In fact, all the way pretty much up to your VO2 max. The contribution with every increase in intensity is a little bit less. Like, if you're looking at two bars climbing at the same rate, like as you turn up the intensity, the fat burning slows bar that goes up is slowing down, and the glucose, the glycogen burning and lactate utilization, all that are just going up much faster. But that fat burning bar, like in terms of calories per minute from fat, is still going up. Like I said, just not very fast. But if I'm going all out, if I run for 30 minutes at the hardest intensity I can and measure how many calories of that run came from fat versus at a 30-minute jog, I'm going to burn more calories from fat because it's an energy source and all energy sources are being used more during that hard 30 minutes.
Agreed. Can women benefit from zone two training? And I don't want to, we don't need to totally derail the podcast with this sort of divisive moment here, but hit me.
I mean, it's the kind of thing where, like, yes, that's a degree, but that's because everybody can. There's in terms of a unique need to do more zone two, or there's even some discussions that women, due to differences in how fat is burned and some kinds of certain efficiency or aspects of efficiency in burning can maybe tolerate more zone two, and that's why women can be very good at endurance events, long distance endurance events. True, but I don't see any reason to prescribe anything differently there. I don't make any considerations. Sorry.
Cool. Good. That's what I was looking for. If you actually, in any context, take that into consideration with coaching.
No, absolutely not.
Do I need to stay in zone two the whole time? I got my Apple Watch. I went out for this, I did this endurance ride on Peloton or something, and I had some minutes in zone two, but it oscillated, it went up into zone three and down to zone two. Does it need to be something I'm staying in the whole time? Does going up and down make it worse?
Yeah,
You don't
going
need to
up and
strongly agree, disagree anymore. You could just answer the question.
down. Yeah, I was gonna say.
Yeah.
Anytime it happens, it quickly derail from that. Yeah, I was gonna say, like, no, I mean, you can go out of it all you want. It's as long as you can tolerate the rest of the work. It's not that the zone two doesn't count. It's that, hey, I'm now adding on more high intensity work. How does that fit into my program? So it's kind of like, hey, if I go out for 60 minutes and I'm like, oh man, I was in zone three for 15 minutes of that, is that going to ruin this zone two workout? It's not going to ruin it unless 15 minutes of higher intensity work on this day was too much for the rest of your program. So it's like, hey, did I really need to take some time off of high intensity work today to let my legs recover, to let me recover for tomorrow's lifting workout, whatever else? Sure. It's not like suddenly that work is no good. It's not like you've ruined the day. Those 45 minutes in zone two are still 45 minutes in zone two. So.
You're not fussed in the so I well I trust me, we've been working together long enough that I highly resonate with what you just said, but just clarify, you are not fussed that I spent 10 minutes in zone two and then I climbed this hill, and I'm putting words in other people's mouths here. I then switched over to carb burning because I was working in a more intense fashion, and started more lactate accumulation, which is blunting my fat burning, and I have to wait for that lactate to clear to get back to fat burning to get back to the benefit of my zone two. Have you ever for one second considered the words that just came out of my mouth?
No, because a lot of that stuff is mechanistically correct. Like, yes, temporarily, like more lactate as an alternate fuel source and signaling molecule means you're using other sources. But practically speaking, it doesn't make a difference because even the benefits to like increase in certain enzymes, responsible for beta oxidation of fat and everything, that still happens. It doesn't magically shut it off because you're now getting an additional contribution from elsewhere.
I also think that the issue for this is that once you start to think that way, even if there were like some partial truths within it, it feels to me an academic discussion, not a practical one. And I feel like if you start to think that way, then you will like, oh, I was supposed to be in zone two, but I climbed that hill. Now you're looking at like, oh, I climbed that hill and I spiked into zone three, zone four, as if that was something that's messing up your zone two. When what you're saying is, yeah, it's not about that reference of how that affects my zone two training. It's how does this period of time I spent training intensely affect my overall training across the week and weeks? And you're almost looking at that zone three to zone four as like not beneficial now because it messed up your zone two, when in reality it's additive. But
Right.
that's the point, it's additive. So you should be considering the fatigue cost of more intense bouts instead of worrying that they've ruined your perfect little zone two session.
Right. Because I think otherwise, a lot of that concern comes from, okay, well, if I'm going at higher intensity, am I still burning fat? If I'm not burning fat, I'm not helping my body burn fat. And it's going, yeah, you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are. And even in spite of all that, like we said, the body still goes and tries to reestablish some sort of homeostasis afterwards. So even if you, even let's say magically you're so high intensity that you're burning a little bit less fat, minute to minute, your body is still going to dip into those fat stores after the workout to maintain homeostasis, to energy balance, and all of that. You're still going to get the same enzyme upregulation, all that stuff. It still happens. So.
Cool. All right, let's do like a minimum maximum single session recommendation for a zone two sesh, and then maybe again, these are challenging things to do. Like, hey, I'm a person who hears and I'm intrigued. I want to add some zone to my life. What's a minimum maximum per session amount that I should consider? And then maybe a weekly, maybe that what would you find is the best way to communicate how much zone two one could add to their week?
So I usually say, like, in terms of a minimum on the day, I usually say, look, any session less than about 10 minutes is probably not worth it. And the only reason I say that is because the first couple of minutes, you're just getting your heart rate up. You're just getting into that. And if you try to make it too bite-sized, you're not really disrupting any system enough to cause adaptation in that short term. And I've said before, when people get hung up on that, I'm like, just subtract the first 10 minutes. I don't mean over the course of the week, take out those first 10 minutes. I'm just saying if you're only doing 10 minutes, it's probably not worth it. So you should try to make it a little bit longer than that. The upper bound goes all the way up to, honestly, I think 90 minutes is about the limit for most people, 90 to 120 minutes per session. And you and I have talked about this a lot. One of the main things is that even though zone two, you could technically do for hours and hours and hours, after about an hour and a half, you start seeing some adaptations like bone density, for example. Like you hit the maximum possible stimulus. It's a little bit like in lifting. Once you're taking a couple sets to failure, taking another set to failure isn't going to trigger more growth. It's with zone two, after about 90 to 120 minutes, you're not triggering much more bone growth. You're not triggering much more mitochondrial adaptation. Like you're kind of reaching the per session maximum stimulus. And you can go longer. There's some benefits for runners who are, training for long races, obviously. We're like, well, I do, 5 hours every weekend. Is that useless? No. It's not useless. But everything past that 120 minutes, you're getting very, very diminishing returns. And that's why I usually say, like, hey, 90 minutes is about the cap on a zone two session to be well recovered from. Past that, you start to get cardiac drift, you start to get dehydration. You get a lot of other things where I'm just going, 2.5 hours into a zone two session, you're probably still stressing your body out disproportionate to the stimulus you're getting from it.
Yeah, I think that's an important point that you're making is that the it's not that the benefits are gone. It's that the SFR gets worse, notably at that point where like, I'm going to use heart rate as a proxy for like how hard something feels just as from to communicate it. But let's say you're my zone two is a 5 mile an hour jog, a 12-minute mile pace, a bit of a shuffle, but it's, I'm there. I'm jogging. And I can hold that pace for, let's say, 3 hours. But for the first 90 minutes, my heart rate is roughly in that 70% max heart rate. It's nice. It's 70% max heart rate, and it feels very sustainable. And it's like, cool, I can live. I can do this, the talk test. I can keep running at a 12-minute mile pace, 5 miles an hour, 2 hours, 2.5 hours, but maybe my heart rate has gone up 15, 20 beats per minute. The perceived exertion is now much higher that I can no longer do maybe a talk test. And in theory, I'm no longer in zone two really at a certain point, like physiologically, but I'm running at my zone two pace. So I'm doing zone two. Essentially what you're saying is, hey, at a certain point, the SFR, the benefits I'm getting become less good compared to how tired I'm getting for this thing. It would be better for me to pack it up, come back tomorrow, do another productive 90 minutes. And no hard cutoffs here, but practically speaking, hey, if you could swing cutting it at 90 minutes and doing another session on another day, it would behoove one.
Yeah, and it doesn't even take a lot of recovery in between because like you said, after about 2 hours, your system is like, well, even though it's not your cardiovascular system that's being super stressed, your body is just under a lot of stress. It just wants to do something else. It wants to rest. But if somebody says, hey, you know what? I've got 30 minutes in the morning, and in the afternoon after work, I can like, hey, maybe ride my bike to and from work or whatever else. 30 minutes out, 30 minutes back. That's perfect. There you go. There's your hour. You want to go for like easy run or a hike in the morning. In the afternoon, you go for a hard walk slash slow jog with your dog. You get in 2 hours a day like that. That's fantastic. That's a great way to do it. All of
Cool.
that.
Cool. Let's do just and the other question was, does modality matter? It doesn't really. I mean, there's some nuances to like heart rate on different modalities, like you said, for sure. But these general subjective proxies, talk test, RPE, they do cross over different modalities.
I will say though, it is much easier to do zone two in a modality you're familiar with. Because I think a lot of people might say, hey, look, I've never ridden a bike before. Should I start doing zone two on my stationary bike? They may get on the stationary bike and say, hey, look, my legs die before the talk test, before I even get close. That probably means, hey, you need a little bit of practice in that modality. Go do some hard intervals, go do a Peloton class or something for a couple of weeks. Get those cycling legs under you. then you'll find yourself better able to tolerate. So a lot of people, if they're like, hey, I want to be doing zone two, I can't run anymore, what should I do? First thing I say is pick a modality that you have the time to get a little bit comfortable with. Do some higher intensity work, then start using it for zone two.
Yeah, that's super great. I'm glad you added that point. That's definitely I definitely experienced that on the Aerodyne when we were starting to do the Echo Bike, where I was like feeling like it was really actually challenging to get to zone two. I was getting really tired, and so I getting better at that modality before thinking I can do 90 minutes of zone two on it was important. So yeah, I appreciate that point. Cool. I want to spend the remainder of time we have. I know that it's gonna be tough to get to this end, some practical implementation stuff, but I want to wax lyrical a little bit about Zone 3. It's been a bit of a love of mine in the past, year and a half we've been working together. And so we talked a little bit about okay, Zone 2 kind of ends at this ventilatory threshold. You can't really hold a conversation anymore. Zone 3 kind of ends at this lactate threshold where training intensity becomes like knowingly unsustainable beyond that point. What does this look like in plain English? What does a zone three workout look like in practice in plain English in terms of programming? And we can go super nerdy. We can talk percentages of lactate threshold, heart rate, or percentages of max. We can do all the things of objective nerdy metrics to subjective plain old English discussion.
So usually the way that the biggest thing I try to keep in mind is, okay, as you get closer and closer to threshold, the amount of time you can spend there goes down pretty dramatically. And as we start to get the threshold, we already said that that's a point, that lactate threshold or whatever you want to call it, is a point where things just start to build up no matter what your body's doing. That is a really profound stress. Now, obviously, there's some benefits to going beyond that. We always said there's no hard switch, but the SFR gets arguably significantly worse. Not that there's not a good stimulus going faster, but it's a lot harder to sustain. So my whole goal with zone three work is to spend as much time as possible close to threshold, just under it, make sure we don't go over it, because that is kind of the sweet spot between, hey, this is a really good stimulus. We're really, really close to this threshold where we've got all these systems working close to max to keep everything clearing. And because of that, you're getting all the enzymes and all of mitochondria, everything responsible for helping your body get in better shape, really, is working close to max, but it's never exceeding that. So you're never flooding the system. So a zone three workout, the real trick here is to know how to stay just under it in such a way that you can accumulate a lot of minutes there overall in the course of a workout and not gas out your athlete. Because we still want to make these sessions you can recover from. So what that ends up looking like is, rather than just saying, okay, let's have you run at threshold, you can do that for 30 minutes, great. We'll have you run at it for 20. That's still really hard. If we say, hey, let's have you run at 95% of threshold or 92% of threshold, a little bit slower for 3 8-minute intervals, we've just got somebody running for 24 minutes close to threshold. They're not feeling super exhausted by it. They may finish each round and be like, hey, that wasn't bad. I'm ready to go again. And so they can accumulate a lot of time there. They can still feel pretty good at the end of it, but they're going to feel worked. That to me is kind of the gold standard of zone three because it's a great stimulus. It is not hugely fatiguing to do the workout, and it is actually relatively easy to recover from.
So the top end of zone three is this, again, threshold. We're gonna I want to speak in kind of terms of absolutes, maybe exaggerate for a purpose here. But let's say right when you cross from zone three to zone four, like you had mentioned, the feeling of how much longer I can keep doing this goes down a ton. The feeling of RPE goes up exponentially. And the benefit of training around threshold is really high. So if I train at 97% of that lactate threshold pace, let's say my lactate threshold pace that I could, we know somehow magically that it's 8 minutes. If I train at 97% of that, I can get almost, and I won't even say almost, I'll say I can get identical benefits at 97% of my threshold pace than at 101, 102%. Because they're so close, so close. But at
Yeah, they're so close.
102%, I've crossed over somewhere physiologically where the SFR has gotten notably worse, where fatigue is beginning to build up precipitously. And I know we're talking about this as if it's on a knife's edge. And there's just elements of uncertainty in here that we layer on top of this. Nobody's talking about it like we know exactly 100% always perfectly where that knife's edge is. But what you're saying is there's benefit to training around our threshold. But there isn't much difference between training just over threshold and training just below threshold in terms of benefit. But there's m a much greater amount of fatigue training above threshold. So if we can train just below it, we're kind of like stealing some of those benefits while getting way less tired doing it. So
Yeah.
the ironically, like not ironically, but knowing a ballpark, I'll say, of your lactate threshold pace, can be really helpful for indicating training, because if we can train just under that, that's where this sort of training is probably, you could say, slightly less good SFR than zone two, but it has a huge S. It has a huge stimulus, really efficient in terms of time and stimulus to time ratio potentially, right? And again, training just above that pace or just below that pace, probably near identical in terms of benefit, but training just under it really does, in truthfully, when it, from a practical standpoint, it increases the amount of it that we can do. And it, increases the amount we can do and decreases how fatiguing it is. And so I'm curious, I guess, a slightly side comment is, we're calling this zone three, we're calling this high-end zone three, but we're also calling it sub-threshold work. And you have some terminology that you use within your programming, and you would call this NT work. I'd be curious where that acronym comes from.
It's honestly just near threshold, which ironically enough is also the acronym for Norwegian training, which is
Nice.
where a lot of that's kind of like why I started using that, because actually a lot of their work is, and granted, they use lactate meters all the time and everything else, but a lot of their work is understanding that a lot of this moderate intensity work does not have to be super hard. And they use lactate meters, really, yes, they'll sometimes have people work really hard, but they also use those when they're doing like some of those 2 day sessions to make sure that they're staying well away from threshold and saying, hey, look, we're not going to let this athlete exceed it, because they know that, hey, this inflection point represents a huge change in this SFR. And with any elite athlete, you're looking at the same thing. You're trying to maximize stimulus while maximizing recovery. And it's that same thing, like, hey, look, if we do near threshold work, we can accumulate 2.5 to 3 hours a week of zone three work. If we do just over threshold, we can maybe only accumulate 1.5 hours of this work. Which is going to be the better stimulus? Well, that 3 hours is probably a marginally better stimulus, because yes, the 1.5 hours is more intense, but there's a lot less of it. And it's easier to program. We can do 2 days at sub threshold, at near threshold, where we probably can't do 2 days at 104%. It's just not going to happen.
Yep. It's a way for us to get in a lot of moderately fast running.
Yeah.
If we can just stay under that lactate threshold, then we can accumulate more of it or get less fatigue from the same amount.
And what's so good about it too is that it's a relatively, you don't need a huge dose at any one point to really make it useful. So one of the things that people sometimes ask me is like, okay, well, can I just do like a 40-minute zone two run and finish with like 10 minutes of near threshold intervals? Absolutely. It's a really good way to do it. And if you do three of those a week, you get in, 90, 100 minutes of zone two, 30, 40, 50 minutes of near threshold. You're going to be in great shape.
That's awesome. Let's talk about programming. And I like that you say that, because maybe that's not picked up by the untrained ear, but basically what you're saying is like a workout doesn't, we can put workouts in buckets because it's helpful to compartmentalize when it comes to programming and conceptualizing, but a workout doesn't just need to be one thing. You mentioned, hey, we're doing zone two for 30 minutes. At the end, we kick, a 3x3 in a sub-threshold pace, or a 2x4 or 1x8 or something. And damn, you got more than just a zone two benefit. Like a workout doesn't necessarily just have to be one thing. It's nice with a, it's nice to have a focus for a workout. And as humans, it's nice to be like, cool, I can start to wrap my head around this being about a certain thing, and that helps me enjoy it a bit more. But like you just said, yeah, that may, one way might be to just incorporate a little bit faster running at the end of a zone two workout.
Makes it much easier to program, makes it really easy to get your head around too.
Yeah, let's talk about. Yeah, in that note, let's talk about programming an NT session. Again, I've had this chat fairly recently about like recalibrating what some of the characteristics of high zone three work it is or are. But if we had to say, all right, you're looking to train sub-threshold work, we're looking at intervals at around this length, and we're looking for maybe a net time spent there across those work intervals of roughly this length. And we're looking to run at roughly this speed. So roughly this speed for this long of an interval, for maybe this many intervals. That's such a challenging question, but if we had to put somebody off on the right foot, what might we say?
Let's say the first thing is take your threshold pace and go 5% slower, which convert it to seconds, add 5% and convert it back to minutes and seconds. And intervals between 3 and 10 minutes long, we'll go with a 4-to-1 work to rest ratio. How does that sound at that speed? And go until you don't want to do the next interval. And I don't mean just like go out, fart like it, and do as many as you want. I'm saying when you put that workout together, you're like, all right, I'm just starting out 5 by 3 minute intervals at that pace with the rest in between. That's probably going to be my limit. Cool. That's how you're starting. Go for it. Because the goal is, hey, look, if in any one session you can end up accumulating between 20 and 30 minutes total, great. So using those guidelines, you should be able to put together a whole battery of pretty good near threshold workouts that give you the target stimulus and don't crush you.
I'll recap that real quick. So intervals around a 3 to 10 minute length, 4-to-1 work to rest ratio. We can poke around a little bit on that, but I think that's a good place to start for people. But another one is 20 to 30 minutes total time spent in the work interval. So an NT workout could be 2 by 10 with a 2 minute break in the middle. It could be 3 by 8. It could be, it'd be 24 minutes. A 2 by 10 would be 10 minutes. A 4 by 5 would be 20 minutes. 5 by 5 would be 25 minutes. So looking to do intervals of a 3 to 10 minute length that accumulate somewhere in the 23 minute range. And again, I get a little squirrely when we try and put such firm barriers up, but to get somebody in the ballpark. Another thing I would put on this is that a lot of times when people do intervals, there's like what I would prefer, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is I would prefer these to be people who follow my group or whatever would know, but like a descending RIR, almost like I don't want your first, like I don't want your, I would love these to be done at the same pace. And this is not like if you do five, if you do 3 sets to failure, you're doing 8 to 10 reps of something and they're all to failure. You're probably gonna have descending reps. You're probably gonna have a set of 10, set of 9, set of 8, set of 10, a set of 8, a set of 6, something like that. That's not what I want people to do with these intervals. I don't want you to be like, cool, my first one is all out and I die. And then the second one is my best effort, but it's slower because I'm tired. And the next one, I'm more tired. And you'd ideally, again, want as close to a consistent performance across the board, with the last interval or two being challenging. But you're not going out there saying, these are, I'm doing 10 minutes as hard as I can, and then 2 minute break, and then another 10 minutes as hard as I can. But it's slower. It's much slower because I'm much more tired. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I would say even in lifting terms, it would be a little bit like your first round should be about 3 RIR and your last round like 1 RIR. And I think what that says is that the first one's actually going to feel pretty easy. You're going to be like, oh, I didn't have to stop yet. I could have kept going. By the last one, you're going to be like, hey, look, that was tough, but it wasn't crushing. I could do another one if I had to. And I think that's, you can kind of go, yeah, okay, if that interval was a little bit longer, or if I had another interval coming up, I'd still be okay. I would love it, but that's kind of that sweet spot. And what you'll know when people start doing it is they always feel like the first interval is a little bit too easy, even though it's not. And the last one, they're like, okay, yeah, I was starting to fade a little bit on that. I'm glad that was the last interval. I could have done another one. I'm glad I didn't have to.
Yeah, you and I've used a triangulation of an RP of like 6, 6, 7, 6, 7, 8, depending on, where we are in training. With a question of, gun to head, if I made you do this again in the afternoon, could you? Hoping the answer should be closer to yes, where it's like, yeah, like this was challenging, but like, if you made me do this again later, I could probably do it. And then something like, an interval or two in reserve. So if people are familiar with like reps in reserve, this being like ending the workout, being like, could you do another one? To me, the way I've been phrasing it to clients, it's like, you should be sure that you could do another one. If you're sure you could do three more, maybe it was too easy. But if you're like, I might have died on that next one, I suspect, again, it's not on a knife's edge where if you happen to go a little too hard, you crumble and burn. But like, ideally, we're looking for an interval or two in reserve. Fair?
Exactly. Yep. I would say that's exactly it. It always the other kind of thing is like, okay, if you got home from this workout and your kid wanted to go out and run a half mile with you, it was like, okay, let's go play. You'd be like, okay, I can do this. I don't have to sit down on the sofa. I may not be super sprightly, but I can go do this. I'm not dead.
Cool. Why aren't pro runners, pro endurance athletes just doing this then? Because what we've said essentially is that this is a place where we can get a huge, really, really high quality stimulus, and we can play a bit of an SFR game in comparison to a little bit faster running, meaning like we're strategically staying just shy of threshold to get basically the same stimulus as over threshold work, but for less fatigue. And so all this sounds like, yeah, super, it's a very efficient way to train. It's a really robust stimulus. You know, we are at least playing an SFR game compared to slightly faster running, where we're getting nearly the same stimulus for less fatigue. Why aren't people being like, yeah, I'm just going to do a bunch of this?
Yeah, I think because there really is a limiting, there is a certain amount you can get per day. Yeah, you can do 2 a days, but you can't do 2 a days every day. You quickly orthopedic fatigue starts to settle in. It is still more stress on your body. You really do get a lot more. You're in a much greater relative energy deficit during the session than you are. You're burning more calories than you can feasibly take in at that time. So there's a lot of that going on. And I think for a lot of elite athletes, once they start getting up to the 2 hour to 2.5 to 2.5, maybe even 3 hours per week of this, they're like, hey, I'm really at my limit here. If we really want to get in, and we even said that like those zone two adaptations, there's almost no upper bound on it. That becomes the dial, like, hey, look, every other tick of the dial on this near threshold work has a pretty big cost, and we have a lot more adaptations that we want to throw in there. Let's cap that for now. We can go over to the zone two dial, crank it all the way up. And now you got athletes able to do 18 hours worth of training a week. That kind of becomes a sweet spot. So it's kind of like at this point, every additional minute you spend on that zone three work, you could easily do a lot more zone two work. So it's well tolerated, but there's still a physical limit to it.
I think that that needs to be underlined, that even though this feels like a really great place to train where you can get a lot of stimulus, there's still a limit. And when you hit that limit, in some ways it's not truly the limit of any fatigue you could handle. It's almost like you have a limit of this higher intensity work, and then you just look over at zone two and you're like, I could do more of that. And so what we end up seeing is that these endurance athletes are doing quite a bit of sub-threshold work. And so and the perception is that they are doing a lot of zone two work because that's the most important thing. They're doing a lot of zone two work because they've already capped out the high intensity stuff that they've done, that they can handle, and their life depends on this as a profession. So they are trying to fill every last piece of fatigue and stimulus that they can get, which means I can't do any more of this high intensity stuff. But my life depends on this. I have a million hours a week to devote to this. I can devote it all to zone two. And again, in conversational terms, incur no extra fatigue, obviously some. And so what you end up having is people doing 80% in zone two, but not because zone two is like the thing that's way more important. It's because it's the thing that they can do more of. And as a person with their entire life riding on this, they're going to do everything they can, which means checking their high intensity box and then all the rest of the time that they can spend, in the low intensity box.
Exactly. They're like, hey, look, I'm doing 2.5 hours of this near threshold work per week. I'm using up 70% of my recovery capacity on this stuff. I could do another hour of this stuff and use up the rest of my recovery, or I could add 10 hours of zone two work in to use up the rest of my recovery. That 10 hours of zone two is going to be a better SFR there. Do I want to do all of zone two? No. I will never, at that point, if you're doing an hour and a half twice a day of zone two, yeah, you can do that all week, but you're going to cap out your stimulus there, and there are going to be some things that those couple stones you left unturned because you're not doing this high intensity. So that's why we end up seeing all these programs that are like, yeah, polarized training, 85, 15%, 80, 20, and all that. A lot of it is simply because it's derived from that.
Just to underline that, and then let's I don't know how much time you have left. Let's move to some practical implication for programming for people who want to get into cardio. But polarized training, this idea of like, I'm doing 80-20, right? I'm doing 80-20. Like 80-20 is for the person training 100 miles a week, right? Like, don't 80-20 your, and by the way, I'm not poo-pooing. You and I run like 100 minutes a week. You know what I mean? I'm not out here running, I'm not that person. So when I say like, don't 80-20 your hour or two a week of cardio, that might not be your best plan. I'm speaking to myself as well. I'm not poo-pooing that work. I think that's just a, again, a lifting analogy is like, if you're doing a ton of volume, a ton of sets, you probably stay a little further from failure. But like, again, if you're not doing as many sets, then that is a less good idea to pick the thing that's a little less fatiguing. You don't need to. You're not doing as much.
Exactly. And I mean, if you use a general guideline, you say, okay, look, the average beginner can probably tolerate 30 to 40 minutes of near threshold work per week. And the average elite athlete is probably doing an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours per week. You're like, okay, there's a pretty big range in there. And it's saying, okay, do near threshold work up to the level of your recovery and then layer on zone two. So saying, look, hey, if I'm doing 60 minutes per week, I would say the most you should ever make the near threshold stuff is probably about 50% of your total minutes. And that's looking at the total time spent doing the interval. So that means I've got a 45-minute workout that has warm up and cool down and rest periods, and only 20 minutes of that is zone three. Great, that's 20 minutes. So already that's like slightly less than 50% of my time right there. So you could almost just do three NT style workouts per week with a long warm up and cool down, and you get all your zone two. You wouldn't be spending more than half your time in that zone three. That's totally progressive. No one is going to burn out doing three of those sessions per week. You know, I say no one, but realistically, like, people are worried about like, oh, if all I do is, you know, I did that where I just ran 3 miles moderately hard every day and I burned out. It's because And going, well, that's because you were just doing like probably threshold work every single day with no easy warm up, no easy cool down. These weren't intervals, these weren't repeats. This is a much more tolerable way to structure the work. So if you say, look, hey, no more than 50%, that's a pretty good way to start, up to a maximum of probably for most of us about an hour to an hour and 20 minutes spent doing those intervals. That's going to give you a pretty good range and some pretty good guidelines to start your program. You can only do 45 minutes a week. Great. 22 minutes of that is going to be, you know, moderate intensity NT work. The rest is going to be zone two. You do 4 hours a week. Great. Let an hour of that be NT work. The rest zone two. Boom.
That's super helpful. That's super helpful. And let's shift to, again, I mean, continue with the practical application implementation side of things. I was thinking of the best way to do this. I'm thinking of the listener, and the person listening to this podcast, you know, probably has some affinity for lifting, starting to hear me talk a little bit more about cardio, feel like it's, you know, people like you and Alyssa and other people on that are like, all right, like, yeah, let's not get winded going up the stairs. Probably a good idea, you know, cardiovascular fitness, you know, let's live longer. Let's do that whole live longer thing. And they're, I don't want to pigeonhole, not everyone's doing this, but let's say somebody's lifting 3 to 4 times a week. What I think would be helpful is instead of giving you an arbitrary, like, what should they add? Let's go through what somebody might do if they can add 1 day of cardio, 2 days of cardio, or 3 days of cardio, and say, hey, I'm lifting 3 or 4 days a week and I have one extra day. Okay, well, what would be the conversation around what I should do with 1 day devoted to cardio, or 2 days devoted to cardio, or 3 days devoted to cardio? And then we'll close quickly with like whether or not that advice overall may change for a ranked beginner. But let's say that it's a person who's has some foundation, even a little bit of a foundation for cardiovascular work. Because I do think if you're a brand new beginner to cardio, especially running, I have a slightly different tone with how I would ease into that. But like, let's say someone has a little bit of a background maybe in some doing some cardio.
I would say that if it's 1 or 2 sessions per week, I would make those the mixed NT sessions. I would say nice, easy warm up, get yourself into zone two, accrue some minutes there, do a couple of intervals using those guidelines we talked about. You don't have to fill up the workout with them, but try to get like, you know, 10, 15 minutes worth of intervals at least in each one of those sessions. So, you know, in your lower bound, hopefully you're accruing at least like 20 minutes of this moderate intensity per week, maybe 30 over those 2 sessions. Then that's great because you can start out with a nice, easy 10, 12-minute warm-up. Do, you know, 3 by 4 minute intervals with a, you know, rest period with a minute rest in between. Finish up with another couple minutes cool down. Boom, there you go. You do that twice a week. Once or twice a week, you're in great shape. That's good. You checked all the boxes there. No one workout's impossible. You can mix up the intervals. So one day you're doing a couple of really short ones. The next day you're finishing with one long one at the end. Who knows? You can mix it up all kinds of ways. I think that's a great way to do it. And it's not super disruptive. Someone says, hey, look, I got some time to get on the bike. You know, I've got 30 minutes to get on the bike, or I've got, you know, 30 minutes to go out for a run. Great. Just structure that workout a little bit differently. End it with a fartlek with these interval guidelines. Once you get to 3 workouts a week, you can probably have 2 of those sessions be like that and have the last one be just all zone two. It's a really easy way. And that also gives you the flexibility of having one workout that's going to be so well tolerated because it's just zone two that you can schedule that. the day before you work legs, and you'll probably be fine. So it's that's one of the other reasons that, we also say, going back a little bit to, well, does this workout all have to be zone two? It doesn't. But workouts that are all zone two are really easy to sprinkle in there because you're less likely to screw anything else up. So when you get to that point, I usually try to keep it, even though you could technically do like NT interval workouts 3, 4, 5 days a week, I usually say, hey, look, let's just do two really good ones and have the rest be zone two sessions. If you're a high-level runner, you can even do like a two-a-day NT session and another NT session on the day, and therefore get three in. There's so many different ways you can do it. But practically speaking, I think that's the best way to go about it.
I think that there will be just, I think one of the interesting take homes there is you aren't, you didn't, in the world where we're in an obsession with zone two, your first suggestion was not a solo zone two day. And I think that that's an important distinction because it just reminds us that, yeah, zone two is great and awesome for what it is. But the less you do, the more you might benefit from something that's a bigger stimulus per time, which may be a little bit higher intensity than that. That you can combine, that you can look at an NT session as also time spent doing zone two, and that you could combine intense a little bit there for sure. I think what I wouldn't run with if I'm the listener is that, oh, like I'm lifting 3 days a week and I'm doing a zone two session, I should 100% switch to something else. I think you and I have even said, like, if you're just thinking about being a little bit more conservative, you don't know necessarily what somebody's recovery is like, especially with people training hybrid. They're also lifting. You want to take into account fatigue, maybe not do too much too fast. If somebody was doing 2 days a week of cardio, also on top of 3 or 4 days of lifting, I think you would nod along with the suggestion of, like, yeah, also nothing wrong with one of those NT workouts and one zone two session, just us playing it slightly conservative fatigue management perspective. And if you're feeling like you're recovering great, maybe you could swap that zone two out for another NT session, maybe get more stimulus in the same time. But yeah, nothing wrong with being a smidge conservative for the hype for the hybrid athlete, just managing the fatigue from both ends.
And you can start really easy. You can start by saying, all right, well, I don't know how well I tolerate this. I'm not going to test my threshold. I don't feel like going out and testing it. Just let me know what I can do to make my sessions already a little bit more productive. And you go, hey, look, let's start easy. Let's just start with 2, 3 minute repeats. That's just a little bit harder. It doesn't have to be the top of zone three. It can be the bottom of zone three. Just go a little bit harder, see how you tolerate it. The next week, go a little bit harder. The next week, maybe do three repeats. Just slowly increase it. You're still getting more benefits. It's not an on-off, you have to do this, or it's not going to do anything.
Yeah, I just for the listener's sake, I'm lifting 3 days a week. I'm running 3 days a week, 3 or 4 cardio sessions a week, and I'm, not a elite endurance athlete by any means, but I'm air quote taking it seriously, air quote like looking to get better. And I will either do 1 or 0 zone two sessions per week, and that's not poo-pooing on zone two. It's just the time allocation that I've told Alex, who's coaching me, that I have to devote to training. I need to be a little bit more efficient with my time. It's like, okay, like the benefit of zone two is you can do a lot of it. I'm not someone who's looking for a thing I can do a lot of. I'm somebody who's looking for a thing I can do less of and get more of a benefit. So we are playing a little bit of a different game. And I just, for the listener thinking, okay, maybe this is, they're talking to just beginners. And first of all, I'm still probably, very much in that beginner bucket, but I'm taking it air quote seriously as trying to progress. And I'm doing, I'm testing myself and I want to get better. And yeah, I'm doing 3 sessions a week. No zone two. Now, not none, but you wouldn't scoff at that. You wouldn't scoff at like, hey, Alex, I'm not doing any zone two. You're like, yeah, I could see a world where that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with, I mean, 16-minute 5K runners who do almost no specific zone two. They do a lot of blended workouts like we talked about. So it runs the whole spectrum from complete beginner to pretty like, middle advanced athletes. Everyone can benefit from it.
Cool. Anything else? Anything that you would change specifically for a beginner? Any extra pieces of maybe not change in prescription in terms of the workouts, but maybe change that you might just layer on top? Any words of wisdom you might layer on top for somebody who maybe even specifically has never run but wants to start running?
I would say the biggest thing about it is if you want to start running, it doesn't mean you have to start running. And what I mean by that is there are a lot of ways to ease yourself into cardio because running is tough. If you are rank beginner at running, the simple act of running probably puts you into mid to high zone three. and it's exhausting and you feel beat up and you might start getting repetitive stress injuries and all that, go easy on yourself. Start with run walks, find another modality you like, put some of that in, and use running sparingly. And always think, okay, this is the sport I'm training for. I can bike, I can walk, I can do stepper, I can do all these other things. Don't feel like you have to make all of those running miles to get the benefits and to become a runner. I work with a lot of runners who started out a running training program, spending maybe 25% of their time running.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm gonna, for fun, just as we close out the pod, I'm scrolling back in my Training Peaks to June 2023. When did we start working together here? I think one of our first workouts was a VT1 test. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I want to look at, I came to you and I said, I want to get better at running. So this is not a general health program. I was like, I want to run. And if I read you our first workout week. Here's our first workout week. We did 6 rounds of a 1 minute jog, and we did some mobility work in there just to assess kind of, I think, some of maybe not mobility, maybe some tightness in my technique. So 6 by 1 minute jog with a minute rest. So 1 minute slow, like a moderate jog, nothing challenging, with a 1 minute rest. And that rest was
Yeah.
maybe like a mobility exercise.
Yeah.
Short workout, 12 minutes. The next day
Yeah.
was a bike, 4 by 5 by 3 minutes on the bike. The next day was a zone 2 bike, and the next day was sprints on the bike. And so, we really, and I came to you having history of shin splints, so I know that that was something we even were more conservative with the introduction of running. But I really, one, I appreciate how we did that, but I really, that will stick with me for a long time, where like I have never had shin splints once with us working together. And if you are, listen, could we have gone faster in an alternate universe? Maybe we could have expedited and I would have been fine too. We don't know. But I didn't get injured. I feel a much more confident runner now. And I owe that a lot to a gradual increase in the running. Right away, we were kicking ass on the bike though. So general gains in fitness on the bike, but the skill of running, the impact of running were something that were best done a bit more gradually. And I really appreciate that. And I feel strongly that that was one of the reasons I didn't crack in the beginning.
Yeah, and I think that's really, really important to look at, especially for anybody who's thinking, oh yeah, but I can't run more than a minute or two. And it's like, hey, I mean, like, given what you just did in the 800 and all that, you're like, okay, I'm you may sometimes poo-poo a lot of that and say, I'm still like, that's a very, very, like, the speed you can attain at this point, given your body weight especially and everything else, you're like, hey, look, this is, you've developed the skill of running to the point where you can start layering on that volume, and it takes time. And people can't get discouraged by that, because like I said, running is not an inherently easy activity for a lot of us, and it's okay to start slow, because that in no way means that your ceiling isn't going to be really, really high.
Yeah, totally. Months into us working together, that workout became 1 by 3 minute interval, and that was because that was our hardest interval. So we do 1 by 3 minute and then 5 by 2 minutes. And so like
Yeah.
you could I just want people to know that when you're running is super fucking hard if you don't run, and don't poo-poo a 10 minute brisk walk with a 10 minute 1-1 walk run with a 10 minute brisk walk at the end. Like, hell of a workout in the beginning. And if you want to, if you're like, hey, I want to get better at running, but I also think having an alternate modality where you can gain more general cardiovascular gains, having something like a bike, something that has a low skill component, a low impact component, is really nice to go alongside you learning how to run.
No, I think that's huge. And I think that should probably alleviate some fears here from, people who may have tried this in the past and been like, yeah, I got burnt out. It's miserable. I hate it. So.
Cool, man. You've been super generous with your time. Super duper fun. Anything we forgot? Anything that you're like, hey, I feel like we should, the listener needs to hear this before we let you go?
Oh man. I can't really think of anything right now. Because I'd say we covered a lot of the bases, and I think I really do just want to continuously go back and emphasize that, like, hey, look, a lot of this stuff, there's a lot of information out there that speaks in absolutes. A lot of this stuff is pretty subjective, even on the science side of things. Like, there's still debates as to what threshold means and the difference between zone 1 and zone 2 and zone 3 and all that. Don't get so caught up on the details. Think more about how you feel and honestly what you enjoy. even on top of that. Like, all of that is just as important because the science is nowhere near as settled. You know, like I said, it all kind of evolved in parallel. There are a lot of things that people still do in the endurance world that are pretty outdated scientifically. So don't get so caught up in that. Just start doing it.
I think the more you do, the more these things matter. But for a lot of us looking for general health, you almost don't have to do so much that you have to worry about it so much.
Exactly. Exactly.
Cool, man. Super, super grateful for your time. And just let people know where they can find you when the book's coming. You have a group program right now that's doing some pretty intense stuff. Give it a plug.
So yeah, I'm easy to find on Instagram, alex.biotta. My company, Complete Human Performance, is in the same place. On my profile, there's links to my group coaching, the Extreme Performance Protocol, which isn't necessarily all that extreme. It's for all levels, but that's interesting to check out. The book is coming out next summer. So I'm in the final phases of finishing up the manuscript and, of course, with publishing and editing and pictures and all this. But you'll be able to find it on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, all those places. Hard copy. Hopefully it'll be great. That's my goal.
I'm sure it'll be great, man. I'm looking forward to hard copy this time around. It's gonna be awesome.
Yeah. Oh man, I can't wait for that. Biggest question I get. When's there a hard copy?
It's awesome. Thanks a lot, Alex.
Cool, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.